Thank you very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. As I told Bill Left that a little bit later, we'll hear from John Meacham, who has the new biography of George Bush out, and we will look at George Bush, the first President Bush, as a leader, and see if there are any things that we can take from his tenure in office and apply to the C-suite or maybe the hot dog stand or wherever in these days today. But first, Frank Sennett from Crane Chicago Business joins us, as he does most Mondays. Frank, welcome to the work week.
Good afternoon.
So speaking of welcome to the work week, one of the stories in Crane's has to do with, the relatively high number of big name, big company CEOs who lost their jobs as we look back at 2015.
Yeah, so nationally, there's actually a decline in the percentage of CEOs who are leaving their jobs. It's about a 10% decline nationally in 2015. So it makes what's happening in Chicago even more interesting, as 5 of the 10 biggest names on Crane's list of publicly traded companies did replace their chief executives this year.
So I'm thinking Walgreens, McDonald's,
yes.
Boeing.
Yes,
right.
And so in some of these cases, it was a planned transition, such as in the case of Archer Daniels Midland, and in the case of Boeing. But in 3 of the 5 cases, there was a move to change horses because of some events like a flawed financial forecast at Walgreens, some slowing sales at McDonald's, and then a federal investigation into United Continental Holdings dealings with New Jersey airport officials. So that led to those changes.
That, the United story, I think it got some play when it happened, but it's still pretty So that he's the guy who took the Bridgegate fall in many ways, right?
Absolutely. And so we had a changeover at United when Oscar Munoz came in after, Jeff Smysak.
Everyone talks about Chris Christie and the construction, but Smysak had apparently set up, or the allegation is, a special route for the Port Authority to go back and forth to his weekend home or something to that effect.
Yeah, and so that that led to his quick downfall.
So that's a specific, but in general, if 3 of these 5 got shown the door, it seems as if being a CEO isn't maybe, I don't want to say as secure, because I'm sure they all got plenty of cash and enough to spend the rest of their lives, but the seat might not be as safe as it used to be.
Yeah, and one of the big experts in the field, John Challenger, the CEO of Challenger Grand Christmas, says that's exactly the case. If shareholders aren't happy, he says, you just don't have long. So the clock starts ticking faster and louder for CEOs these days with activist shareholders.
And the thing is, a CEO can go, but it's not one person usually. It's a team, and then that reverberates all the way down the chain.
Yeah, at Walgreens, for instance, there's been a big house cleaning since the CEO changed. A lot of C-suite executives have turned over there. So, yeah, that's to be expected in a lot of these cases.
All right, so we like to talk about small businesses and startups here. And this company, I think they're called Salt. Is that the name of the company?
Salt Supply.
Salt Supply, and they're not supplying what you might think.
They are not competing with Morton's, no. What they are doing is selling a non-lethal defense device that looks like a handgun, and it shoots a 70-caliber plastic sphere that's filled with a proprietary mix of powdered chemicals. But the main thing is ghost pepper, same that many law enforcement agencies use for crowd control. So basically, bad guy breaks into your house, you're supposed to shoot that person with this pepper spray pellet.
Right, and so you're not wounding them. I think the equivalent they said is like being hit in the chest with a baseball at 50 miles an hour.
Yeah.
But you're disabling them with the pepper spray.
Right. And so the folks that put this together are a couple of neighbors who moved into Humboldt Park in 2014. They were concerned about the violence that they saw in the neighborhood, but they didn't want to have guns in their house. So they started looking at this non-lethal solution, and they've tried it out on themselves. And I guess one of the founders says
that sounds like a party.
Yeah, exactly. He had a board in front of him, so he didn't take the full impact. But he said he couldn't open his eyes for 10 minutes.
Okay, so this seems like a great idea. I mean, if we agree that, there are, I guess not everyone agrees. I shouldn't say that. But many people think there are too many guns around. We need a way to protect ourselves from intruders. This would be maybe a very nice alternative, but they can't get the funding.
Well, they couldn't get the funding through online crowdsourcing because they don't allow the terms of service for Indiegogo would prohibit the offering of any weapons. And so they're saying it's a safety device, but if you take a look at the picture, it looks like a gun. So that was pulled. But they had a private funder who funded the initial round, and they're actually taking orders at saltsupply.com, and they are ready to ship. Apparently not in time for Christmas, however. They won't go out until January, they say.
Salt Supply. Okay, so, you know, a great thing, way to defend you, make you feel a little bit more safe in your home. Do you suspect that most of those pellets will be fired in defense or at parties of people wanting to know what it's like?
You have one of those parties like you have ghost pepper tasting right. parties, ghost pepper shooting, but yeah, frat house near you.
Is there a Pinot that goes with the ghost pepper? That is Frank Sennett from Crane Chicago Business. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks, Steve.
You're listening to the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. It's 12:20 on a Monday afternoon. Steve Bertrand here. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. And there's nothing like a Monday morning conference call with legislators from around the country. That's the way I like to start my day. Will Gazzardi, is that the way you like to start your week? Welcome to the program, Will.
Have me on, Steve.
State Representative Gazzardi. And so the subject of this conference call is this idea of a zero-debt college education for students across the country. And I've got one in, and I've got one getting ready to go in. The idea of a debt-free education sounds great, but I don't know how you guys pull that off.
Yeah, well, first of all, it's becoming a more and more nationally recognized issue. You know, we've got all three major Democratic presidential candidates with plans to make college debt-free, public institutions of higher education debt-free. And we're seeing it, as you said today, we had state legislators from 10 different states, red states, blue states, purple states, who are proposing resolutions to advance this idea of debt-free college. So it's really gaining traction. And recent polling says that it's extremely popular across all political spectra. You know, we have 71% of people who were polled approve of the idea of debt-free college, 19% are opposed. So it's a very popular idea. People really want it. And so it's our responsibility to figure out a way to do it.
We're talking to State Representative Will Gazzardi about this move for a debt-free education. Okay, so it was introduced in some red states, but was it introduced by red state legislators or reg?
Well, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, it's okay.
Right now, it's really been Democrats taking the lead on this issue. And I think we have an important contrast here in Illinois. You know, we've got a Republican governor who proposed a 30% cut to higher education, a governor who proposed enormous cuts to our MAP grant, the Monetary Assistance Program. You know, we still haven't funded the MAP grant for this year. And despite the Democrats having passed legislation to fund that program back in May, the governor vetoed that bill. So, you know, Republicans in the state and I think around the country have moved toward limiting access to higher education. And we, I think Democrats, believe very strongly that every family ought to have the opportunity to send their kids to higher education without having to be saddled with enormous amounts of debt. And especially given that the workforce is going to be headed toward a direction that requires post-secondary education down the road, in order for our young people to have a possibility at the careers of the future, they're going to need a college education.
Okay, I'm all for it. I think it's a great idea and a wonderful goal, but I'm not sure I understand how you can possibly do it. How can you do it?
Yeah, so that's certainly a sticking point. You know,
that's where things get a little trickier.
It is, of course. No, and I don't mean to suggest that it's going to be easy or readily done, but there was a time in this country when high school wasn't free for everybody, right? And we decided as a society that in order to prepare our young people for the careers that they were going to have to face, they needed a high school education. And so we stepped up and funded high school education for every child. We still do it. And it's a very successful program that makes sure a lot of our young people get high quality education. And I think it's time for us to make that next step, to decide that college, too, is something that every child should be able to attend without having to get saddled with debt. And, yeah, it's going to require us to invest resources in it. But as we saw with things like the GI Bill, when we invest in people going to college, that investment pays off big, big dividends down the road.
So
I think that
I'm sorry, Representative. I didn't mean to interrupt you that time. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead, please.
Well, so are we envisioning, then as I hear you talk, I'm thinking, okay, so Notre Dame is still going to be there, Northwestern's still going to be there, but maybe there's a sort of new educational infrastructure where we have the local college, which is maybe more an extension of high school than it is what's currently the University of Illinois.
Mm-hmm. And I think that there's... you know, there's been a strong initiative, especially here in the city of Chicago, to make our community colleges, both to improve the quality of the curriculum at those colleges and to make them more affordable and accessible to low-income families. I think they can often be a good bridge between high school and a four-year college education. And so I think that's a good place to start looking. But I think that our public institutions of higher education, the University of Illinois and the other similar institutions out there, you know, these are meant to be ways for every Illinoisan to get a post-secondary education and to prepare themselves for the jobs of the future. And when you have to graduate from U of I with tens of thousands of dollars in debt, we're just not doing right by our families. So I think that something's got to change.
Okay, so, Representative, I'm trying to get my arms around the whole thing. You're talking about everyone who would go to college would leave debt-free, or you're talking about people who can't afford to go could afford to go debt-free?
I'm talking about public universities, right?
Okay.
So institutions of higher learning that are part of the state of Illinois system, or the community public community colleges that we have, that those institutions would be would have policies in place such that no student had to take out loans.
No student, regardless of
of
income. Okay, so that would create...
So the point being that if your family can afford to pay for you to go to college without taking out loans, then by all means, that's what should happen. But if your family can't afford the full cost of tuition without taking out loans, your family should pay what they can, and the remainder should be made up in the form of grants and scholarships.
I got you.
So studying everything else, the full menu.
So we're talking about kind of a need-based extension rather than a universal extension.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I think that at least as an interim step here, you know, we need to make sure that no family has to borrow money in order to get their child a quality public post-secondary education.
Well, I wish you great luck with it. I hope that you're not tilting at windmills, but I know you've got a big, big fight ahead of you, Representative. Would you tell me, are you tilting at windmills? Is that a windmill in front of you?
Look, I think that the massive public support around this issue is going to urge our legislators to take action on it sooner rather than later. And the reason that we wanted to introduce this resolution is to show the public that we're taking action and to show the legislators in Springfield that this is an issue that needs their attention.
Representative Will Guzzardi of Chicago, thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for your time, Steve.
You bet. You're listening to The Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. John Meacham has been on more political talk shows in the past 6 weeks, I think, maybe than Donald Trump. And it's a good thing because he is there reminding us of a Republican who might be the anti-Trump, reminding us of George Herbert Walker Bush. John, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Name of the book is Destiny in Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. You've probably, I'm sure everyone listening has read about it, heard about it now, the conflicts in the younger Bush administration. This is a business show, so I want to focus on leadership and leadership issues. And I want to do it with two key phrases from George Bush's career. One, read my lips, and the other, this will not stand. All right, so let's start with read my lips. It's the convention, right? Leading up to his nomination.
It's August 1988. There was a debate over whether he should be that inflexible rhetorically on taxes. He said, the Congress will push, and I'll say no. The Congress will push, and I'll say no. The Congress will push, and I'll say, read my lips, no new taxes. Dick Darman, who was a Jim Baker ally, had tried to get it out of the speech, didn't think he needed it. Interestingly, it came from the Midwest. Roger Ailes had used a version of it in a campaign he had done the media for Chuck Grassley.
Oh, really? Iowa?
In Iowa. So it had worked there, and so they thought it would work with Bush. The lesson there, because I asked President Bush once, you know, what's your greatest regret in political life? And I thought he would say losing 92. He said, shouldn't have said read my lips. It's a case of doing the politically expedient thing when your gut tells you you're probably not going to be able to live up to it.
He talked to Michael Dukakis not long after the election.
Fascinating conversation.
He kind of copped to the fact that he was going to raise taxes.
Dukakis was standing there, and Governor Dukakis told me the story, but said that Bush said, well, I can't raise taxes in the first year. And Dukakis was like, you just killed me, you know, saying you were never going to raise them. It was a Chicago. It was Dan Roskinkowski who gave Bush the space to be able to keep the pledge even a year. I think the lesson is if you don't believe it, don't say it.
So that is a lesson in bad leadership.
I think it's a lesson. Well, here's the thing. He hurt only himself. He actually helped the country, I think, when he broke it.
Well, that's what I wondered. I mean, maybe he did. Maybe you could look at it to where it was deceptive to get his goal, or you could look at it to where it was almost self-sacrificing to achieve a greater goal.
Well, they were both true at different times. On the front end, it was instrumental. He was saying something to consolidate the base of the party, to draw the bright line between him and Dukakis. He was trying to convince the movement conservatives who had never really trusted him that he was one of them. But then, ultimately, in the summer of 1990, he believed that the national interest required his breaking that pledge, and he took the judgment, took the risk of judgment. He took it all on himself. He never whined. He never complained. He knew in real time that it was going to cost him. He told me once, he said, I knew I was dead meat.
As he was making the deal, not as he was making the speech.
As he was making the deal.
Right, right. Second one, this will not stand. Pretty much more uniformly praiseworthy, I think.
August 5th, 1990, it was a Sunday afternoon. He was coming back from Camp David. On his audio diary, which I listened to for the book, you can hear him on Marine One coming down. And you can hear the blades. You can hear the chopper blades as he's talking about how he worries that if Saddam is allowed to hold on to Kuwait, he would pose a threat to Saudi Arabia. If Saddam were to go into Saudi Arabia, he would have a new world war. It's a startling moment to hear a president of the United States in real time say a new world war.
Right.
And so he gets off the chopper, walks over to the press and says, this will not stand, this aggression against Kuwait. And that's his finest hour. He set up a coalition. He did it through outreach, 35 nations, defined the mission, carried out the mission. And that was that.
You know what I like most about that moment as compared to Read My Lips? You just said, you know, Roger Ailes came up with that line.
Right.
When it comes to this shall not, or will not stand, after he gives it, he's walking away. And Brent Scowcroft says, where'd you get that? And what was his answer?
It's mine.
It was genuine.
It was genuine. It came straight from his heart. And Scowcroft said, well, yes, sir, we'll make that happen now.
So here we are in 2015 facing an enemy from the Middle East, a very different enemy, a much harder, I think, probably to defeat him, enemy. Can Hollande or Obama or any world leader form a sort of coalition that Bush formed then?
I don't, you know, terrorism by its very nature is an asymmetrical threat. Interestingly, this, you know, because ISIS claims to want a geographic base, that's part of being ISIS, or ISIL, there will be targets to hit. You know, the British have now authorized airstrikes. So there will be ways to take out training camps, that kind of thing. I think the more troubling thing is this decentralized radicalization. And are there people, you know, we used to call them sleepers, remember, in the Cold War?
Right.
Are there sleepers in the United States, which was always part of the fear early on?
John Meacham is here. The name of his book is Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. And as we sit here, I'm thinking of another one. And this is something I've learned just in reading the book and watching some video about it that I didn't realize at the time, or it makes perfect sense. And that was the fall of the Soviet Union. That might have been a time when a U.S. leader would gloat,
right,
would beat his chest. And I think that's a real statement to leadership, too. George Bush did not do that.
Restraint. He believed in restraint. And what he also was able, and this is the key key capacity of any leader, along with the ability to inspire. He was able to put himself in the other guy's shoes. And he put himself in Gorbachev's shoes. The Berlin Wall comes down. He knows that Gorbachev has a right wing. He knows that there are going to be communist bitter enders who might try to topple Gorbachev, who might try to open fire in East Germany. What is in Bush's head that's not in our head historically at this distance was Tiananmen Square. In June, there had just been a repressive regime that had opened fire on protesters. Mm-hmm. So that was a live possibility for him. He believed, Bush believed, that the more restraint he showed, the stronger Gorbachev's hand would be, and the more peaceable the end of the Cold War would become. And
so
he was right.
We can't know a man's leadership from three issues that we did so quickly there. But from Bush, what do you think business leaders, CEOs, or guy running the hot dog stand can learn to become a better leader?
The key lesson of George H.W. Bush's life is about personal connection and using personal connections, friendships, relationships to build a culture of consensus. Not that a guy is going to be with you 9 times out of 10, but if that person knows your motives are good, you might get 2 out of 10. And in a democracy, 2 out of 10 is pretty good.
I want to ask, too, about Bush when it comes to something struck me when I'm reading about the book is the idea that Bush was driven to win. He wanted to win things. So was he more of a guy after the win? Did he want to win more or lead more?
He wanted to lead, and to lead, he had to win.
So, okay, so the motivation was leading, not winning.
I think the overarching...
I mean, I'm thinking of, you know, the fact that maybe he wasn't always able to articulate why he wanted to be president and things
right.
like that, but he knew he wanted to win the presidency.
He knew he wanted to win the presidency, but he knew he wanted to win... He didn't want to win it out of a raw ambition. He had the country's good at heart, and the evidence for that is that he did things repeatedly as president that were against his own interests in winning a second term. Breaking Read My Lips, to bring us full circle. He knew in breaking Read My Lips that he was endangering his reelection. He was sending the right wing off in rebellion against him, but it was the right thing to do. And he, if you ask him now, what do you want your legacy to be? The L word, as he calls it. He says, I hope they say I always put the country first.
That's John Meacham, the name of the book, Destiny and Power. Thanks very much. It was nice to talk to you.
Thanks, Steve.
You're listening to The Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thank you, Steve Alexander, Kim Gordon, and Don McCarthy. I'm never going to learn. Okay, that's Alexander in the business office. And with any luck at all, he's going to go home now for the rest of the day. You're going to be around for a while?
No, I'm leaving.
All right. Well,
he has
listen,
the nicest manners of all of us.
He does. I know he does. And I'm grateful for
thank
that.
Thank you.
Sometimes.
Katie, you're welcome.
Katie Hill, I'm going to shut all of you off, writes for MarketWatch. Katie, it's hard for me to do my job when I'm surrounded by people like this. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Maybe I should be looking for a new job. Wait a minute. Those days are gone. So I was amazed by this piece you wrote. I think it was maybe last Friday about the idea that nowadays more and more of us are on a perpetual job hunt. It sort of never ends.
That's right. I mean, a couple of surveys that came out recently showed this. One from Indeed that said 2 in 3 workers are already looking for a new job within the first 3 months of getting a new job. And then a Career Builder survey found that 1 in 3 workers say they're just pretty much always looking for a new job. So a whole bunch of research saying, you know, people are, they have a job and they're already looking for a new one. I mean, the times of staying with the same company for decades are definitely over.
Yeah, it's interesting to me because, you know, I like to talk about loyalty and the idea when I tend to think of it, is that maybe an employer should have a little bit more loyalty to the employee. But you look at numbers like this, it probably goes the other way around as well.
Oh, I think for sure it goes the other way around. And now, I mean, employees really have, you know, unemployment's around 5%. They really have more options for jobs. They feel secure. They're like, you know what, maybe now I can get, you know, better benefits somewhere else. Or, you know, I mean, a million things that they're looking for. And now it's kind of a good time for them. So that might be why we're seeing these high numbers.
Well, you know, and the other thing is when the jobs have been coming back, but the idea that wages have been increasing sort of has been lacking. We've been behind in that. But according to what you write and what people who study this say, this really isn't so much about the money.
Right. So when you look at what makes an employee stay at a company, what they say makes them happy, obviously pay does matter, but it tends to be number 4 or 5 on a list of things that matter. Career advancement and a number of studies is usually number 1. Employers, bosses, other colleagues who treat you with respect, people you can trust, the people you work with, those are really important. And for a lot of people, especially as you get, millennials like work, things like extra vacation, when you get in your 30s and 40s and you have kids, you really like work-life balance. So benefits matter to people. All of those often matter more than pay to workers.
So if you are a boss, what do you take out of these numbers?
I think, you better treat your employees, especially now, with as much respect as you can. Really work with them on, here's how you can advance in this job, because that's what's making them stay. And it is super costly, in terms of money, but also in terms of people's time to replace someone. So I think they really need to work on what is going to make us retain our employees.
See, and I read these studies, and I cut their pay, and I give them Fritos in the cafeteria because they want benefits, not money.
Fritos are always a good plot.
Maybe the Cool Ranch nachos, whatever it takes, but I want to keep them happy that way. But it sort of is, and it's nice, isn't it, that, well, I think that's nice, that the idea is that being happy in the workplace sometimes is more important than being the amount of money you're taking home.
Right. I mean, if you're paying someone within what's reasonable for their position, they're probably going to be all right with that. And so then they put other things way above pay. I mean, obviously, if they're just not getting paid enough and can't make ends meet, that's a different, kind of situation. But for most people, when they're getting the average pay for what their position demands, they think, oh, I just really want to work with nice people. I want to be able to leave at a reasonable hour. I don't want to constantly be on call. Just basic, simple, treat your employees well kinds of things. And that's what gets employees to stay at their jobs.
I read somewhere, or I was hearing about a study of workers and salary, and the idea was that what they wanted most was this idea of fairness, that if they felt they were being paid fairly, they were happier than if, obviously, they thought they were being paid unfairly. But, if they were to say, let's say they make $50 a week, if they were making 50 and their coworkers were making 50, they were happier in that situation than if they were making 70, but their coworkers were making 100. So the idea is if they thought they were being unfairly paid, even if they were making more, they tended to be less happy.
That makes complete sense to me from other research I've seen as well. And the same thing with benefits. It's interesting with these maternity leave and paternity benefits. You see, a couple big tech companies giving extended benefits and then all these other companies following suit because these other companies realize, oh, hey, well, they're doing it. That's something employees want. And it kind of like we need to do that if we're going to get this amazing talent that they have. And so, I think people do compare themselves to other workers and they do want the same things. And when they feel like other people are getting better pay or better benefits, it does. It upsets them more than, it just upsets them.
And all kidding aside and putting aside the cost of Fritos, some of this would be expensive for employers, but a lot of it wouldn't. I mean, this is what you're saying is creating a positive workforce, a workplace, a place where people want to go is a long way toward keeping talent. And that doesn't always cost that much.
No, right. And some of these really don't cost a thing. I mean, allowing your employees to have good work-life balance, that doesn't necessarily have to cost you anything. I mean, a lot of times employees, it's not that they want to work less. It's just that they, hey, I want to leave at 3 o'clock so I can go see my kids play, right?
Right.
I'm happy to work, later on at night. I mean, that's something that could be completely free. And look, I mean, the number one thing, people want career advancement and they want, employers, bosses that they can trust and respect. Those are free.
Katie Hill from MarketWatch.com. Thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Business Lunch on 720 WGN.